wilderness is not a luxury, but necessity of the human spirit. Edward Abbey.
We were still early enough on the approach. Four of the five were gone. And we get to this Passover point. I forgot what the actual, there's a technical name for it. It's like the nose or something that you like have to pass through, like the wedge maybe. And then you start climbing onto the backside and up and around to the actual peak. So we get to that point, and it's a technical scramble. I think it was a class 3, class 4 scramble. And my friends was like, dude, I'm out. Like, I don't feel good about this. I'm gonna start down climbing. And I was like, okay, well, like, what's the time now? How long do I think I need to get up there and back? Do I go alone? And end up making the decision that I feel strong enough. I've got everything I need, and I can figure it out. And we had seen a few people coming up and down, so I knew I wasn't totally remote. So I made the call to just kind of push on. I'm starting to climb up this great field, and I'm just jumping big rock to big rock because it's, you know, with the hiking boots on, I'm getting all sorts of rocks all in my shoes at this point. And I'm just jumping up, sliding down. So it's total definition of one, like two steps forward, one step back, because I am sliding back down. And I start trying to, in my mind, play Frogger, where I'm just trying to find the biggest stone that I can, jump on that and hope I don't slide. And I'm just kind of Froggering my way up to the top of this mountain. I get to the back section and it's still iced over. And there were definitely I didn't think at this point, which I should have taken more time to assess the approach. But I was like, I need to get up there. I feel good about where I'm at bouldering wise. I boulder on the side as well.
I'm Doc, and this is the John Freakin' Muir Pod.
Welcome to the John Freakin' Muir Pod. Lace up those boots and sling on the pack for a romp through trails, short and long. With your host and Renaissance man, Doc, it's time to embrace the suck.
Welcome back to another week on the trail. I'm Doc. This is the John Freakin' Muir Pod. Let's start off with a reminder. If you are enjoying the podcast, take just a minute, help us out, leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. And if you're not enjoying the pod, well, just go ahead and keep that to yourself. All right, let's get to this week's guest, whom I reached out to at the suggestion of one of our listeners. I love that when the listeners interact with me and say, hey, you know what? Have you talked to this guy? Have you heard of this guy? He needs to be a guest on your show. So I reached out, and this week's guest got right back to me. And I want to welcome to the John Freakin' Muir Pod, Kevin Gong. How you doing, Kevin?
I'm doing great, Doc. Thanks for having me on the podcast, and excited to chat with you.
We obviously have some mutual fans in common.
Yeah, it's wonderful. Somewhat surprised, but also ecstatic that someone's followed my lifestyle, inspired to go outside and just explore it outdoors.
Okay, nice. Now, usually on the podcast, should we go by trail names? Doc is not on my paycheck. Or on my driver's license, but that's my trail name. Have you happened to pick up a trail name in all your outside adventuring?
You know, I have not. I haven't done too many trail or like through hikes or anything where I've gotten a long enough time out there where folks are calling me by a nickname. So it's just Kevin for now.
Okay. Well, you know, I have a tendency to try and pick out a trail name during the course of an episode. So maybe we'll find something to make it stick. I don't know. We'll see.
All right. Maybe we're in for a treat here.
All right. Hey, have you listened to any episodes of the podcast?
I listened to one, yes. And it was, I forget which one it was actually, but it was about a month ago. I can't remember the exact name of the guy anymore, but I do remember being a little enthralled by just like how I think he had done the PCT. And it's just, I don't know, it's impressive. Someone had kind of, it started getting my gears fitting, right? Like, do I want to do a, you know, multi-week trip down the US? But yeah, it was pretty neat. I feel bad. I'm forgetting the name now. I need to go back and
that's okay.
Remind folks.
That's okay. This is at its heart, this is a human interest podcast. It's the stories behind the people. And I think everybody's got a story to tell. And, most of our stories, all of our stories focus around outdoor adventure, but really, I just love to hear the stories from their perspective and what they've had to overcome in their lives and how the outdoors has helped them to overcome that. So everybody's got a story, including you. And we are excited to hear your story tonight.
Awesome. Yeah. Excited to share.
Okay. Hey, towards the end of the episode, I'm going to turn to you and I'm going to ask you for your pro tip insight of the week. Cause anybody that appears on the podcast is a pro in my estimation. You've now appeared on a podcast. So you'll be a seasoned pro by the end of the episode, and you'll be able to share some nugget of wisdom for our listeners to make their next outdoor experience even better. So be on the lookout for that. Don't be surprised.
Gotcha.
Okay. Hey, another segment that I've done recently that you have no idea about is a current event. So I'm going to surprise you with this and just kind of pick your brains and get your reaction to something that's going on in the world of the outdoors very recently. So I go through different headlines and look for different things out there. And I came across this exciting new trail that's going to open up pretty soon. I'm not sure when it's going to open, but it's called the Lost Sierra Route. Have you heard of this?
I haven't heard of that. Anything lost and needing to be discovered sounds quite awesome though.
And in the Sierras, right? So this is a 600 mile network of trails that connects 15 Northern California mountain towns and Reno, Nevada.
Wow. That's so massive.
That sounds pretty cool. I mean, it's three times as long as the John Muir Trail, basically. And you're winding your way through these different small towns up in the mountains in the Sierras. It sounds pretty crazy. And it's open to hikers, bikers, and pretty much anyone else, according to the story that I saw.
Oh, wow. I love the multi-use too. That's actually quite awesome. I'm, trying to get more into the world of bikepacking and being up in the Alpines and with a bike too, I think is just quite awesome. Sometimes it ends up being more of a hike and bike than anything, but, wow, that's impressive.
Yeah. Now with bikepacking on those severe uphills, because I know you have some biking experience in your background. We're going to talk about that, but it's a chore for a hiker to carry his or her backpack up a severe incline. Now with a bike, do you end up walking next to it? Do you have to eventually carry it at some points of some extreme routes, or how does that work?
Yeah, it depends on the trail. So generally speaking, if the terrain is, I guess, strong enough, and you're not going through anything too rocky, I feel like on a gravel bike with the right, pressure, you're able to get up it. Sometimes though, you end up sliding, or if you're exhausted, you just kind of start losing grip, and it's sometimes better just walk or even take a break. But generally I found I've been able to get up most inclines, albeit I haven't tried anything too intense. There was one road that kind of surprised a friend and I up in Northern California, and we sort of remember the name of the road, so just to never go back to it with fully loaded packs. It's called Fish Rock Road, and I would not recommend doing that with a fully loaded pack on road tires, because we were sliding out all over the place, and luckily no flats though, but we were going about 3 miles an hour the whole time. So not even much faster than someone walking it.
Yeah. 3 miles an hour. I can do that.
Yeah. Yeah. No, we were just so scared. We were going to pop the tires and have to unload the whole bike. And we were already pretty late in the day. So we were just trying to get back to the cars at that point. That was our last day.
Okay. Now, in addition to your biking experience, do you also have some multi-day hiking experience as well?
Yep. Yep. That's kind of how I got started. It was, moving back to the Bay Area, I'd spent some time in Indiana after college, and moved back to the Bay Area, and had some friends that were just already kind of on the backpacking kick, and just kind of grabbed me one weekend and said, "Hey, grab a backpack, grab a pack, like figure it out. We're getting out there." So I started doing I started with an overnighter, which was, 2 miles hiked in, pretty easy overnighter. And then started expanding into some multi-day loops. I think the biggest, or one of the bigger loops I was able to do, was the Grand Canyon of the Tuolumne, which was that kind of by White Wolf in Yosemite Valley. Mm-hmm. And that was three nights that we had spent the first night backpacker camp, and then kind of descended into the valley and did another night chasing waterfalls, if you will, all the way up out of the valley into Yosemite Valley, Tuolumne Meadows area. That was an awesome trip.
Okay. And we're going to talk about some of your experiences here in just a little bit, but I wanted to ask just to inform our next segment, which is the Must Bring Gear Review sponsored by the Ultralight Backpacking Gear Company, Outdoor Vitals. And so here's how it works. If you were to let a stranger pack your bag with pretty much generic gear for a multi-day hike, what is the one specific piece of gear you would insist on being packed? And if you've got a particular brand for that specific piece of gear, even better. So Kevin, what's your must bring piece of gear?
I've really enjoyed having a sleeping bag liner. I found it's a game changer with regards to warmth. And I also think it probably preserves the life of the bag. I haven't gotten to a point where I've needed to replace any bags yet, but the liner has been amazing, and it's relatively lightweight. I've got a silk one from, I think, Sea to Summit is the brand. Mm-hmm. It's been a game changer. I was recently camping in Yosemite in the snow and was actually shedding layers in this little liner. I was also in a little tent with another body, so I was a little warm, I guess, but was shedding layers, and this liner really, really held up its weight. So really appreciate the folks over at Sea to Summit for making that.
Yeah, sleeping bag liners, you can get them in varying degrees of assistance, I guess you would call it. I mean, it could add an additional 10 degrees, 15 degrees, 20 degrees, depending on the, you know, the composition of the sleeping bag liner. So you could have maybe a summer bag and you're going out in the fall. And if you take a liner, that could possibly help you in that area. And it also, like you said, it keeps the bag clean and preserves the lifetime of the bag. So,
yeah. I think I've got a 20 degree bag with like a 5 degree liner, and that held up, and we got snowed on for a foot. And it held up pretty well, I'd say.
Okay. Fantastic. Hey, I've got another segment relating to gear. Helps us talk about some gear and your reasoning behind your gear. And I call this segment the hiking pole, and it's not P-O-L-E, it's P-O-L-L. It's a little clever play on words there. And this is going to help me determine where you fall on the craziness scale. All right. Okay. So I'm going to give you a score at the end of this. I've got 6 questions for you.
Sounds good. Yeah.
Okay. We'll start off easy. Trekking poles or no trekking poles?
I go trekking poles.
Yeah. Did you have any concerns about using trekking poles at first?
I did. In that I thought it was going to be clunky and unwieldy. But I found with any sort of crossings and or if my knee starts acting up, it's an amazing way to, just get the extra like support and stuff that you need. If you're going through anything slippery, and you know, I really used them actually quite heavily on the third day of, the Lost Coast Trail. I was climbing over those boulders and sand, just mixed terrain. It really cemented that those extra grams are worth it for me in case I come up with any terrain that seems unwieldy. So I now pack it, even if I know it's going to be a small hike, just to have them. It's kind of a nice little psychological safety, if you will.
Yes. So far, you're not too crazy. I wholeheartedly agree with that assessment. They are very, very helpful. And I think people have an initial concern of I'm going to look funny with these. I don't know how to use these. And there's maybe an initial reluctance to use them, but once you have them, I mean, there's no going back.
Absolutely.
Okay. Boots or trail runners?
I go boots. I like the ability to splash around or get mucked up if I need to. I haven't actually explored any trail runners. I've never hiked with or done any long distance stuff with trail runners.
Okay. Well, if you ever do long distance, I mean, all the long distance hikers, they swear by the trail runners. Mm-hmm. What kind of boots do you use? What brand?
I think I've got some Oboes right now. And then I just bought some Arc'teryx trail runners, but I haven't used them on any hikes yet.
Okay. Well, you have to give them a try and let us know how it goes.
Definitely.
Okay. Tent, tarp, or hammock?
Oh, so I have all three, and I'd say it depends on the occasion. I actually hammocked a lot in the East Coast. I just feel like there's more accessible trees to swing up a hammock on. I would tarp if it's bike packing. I found that's pretty easy to do, and I've actually used my bike as part of the teepee, and then just blue tarped it, and now I've got a little teepee set up. And then tent for most everything else.
Okay. What percentage would you assign to each one of those in terms of how often you use them?
Ooh, I think probably mostly tent. I mostly am, you know, camping or, yeah, I think I'm mostly camping in hiking and backpacking. The trail, like our bike packing is still, I guess, becoming a bigger hobby. So I'm starting to use the tent or the tarp a little bit more. But I've actually packed with some panniers, and I've used the tent before as well, but I think I'm going to change that setup soon. So I'd say 80% tent, if 70% tent, and then 20-ish percent tarp. The hammock was only for a few times when I was out on the East Coast and camping.
Got it. Now the tarp, do you use it exclusively with the bike as part of a kind of a single type of pitch with the bike involved, or do you experiment with different pitches with the tarp?
I haven't experimented too much with the tarp. It's mostly just like, let's see, I tie off the, I tie both sides. Maybe it's like an A-frame, I guess, except instead of a string in the middle, I use just the bike. It's not much room, but I just slide right underneath and hope it doesn't rain, but it's enough coverage where I'm generally protected. But there was one, actually my first bike packing trip was a little bit of a stealth camping, and definitely thought I heard some animals coming up on me in the middle of the night. So I, you know, I kind of slept with my knife next to my face, just trying to be prepared, and, you know, whipped it out, flashed the headlight on, and you know, thought I heard some sort of cat or something. Couldn't figure out what it was in the morning. But I definitely wished I'd packed a tent in that trip moment.
Because that thick tent wall is going to protect you from that mountain lion or the bear.
Exactly. The super, super thick, like 2 millimeter tent wall would have protected me. Yep.
Yeah. It sounds kind of cramped with the bike there serving as the structure for the A-frame. And I realize that you probably don't carry hiking poles, trekking poles when you're bike packing, but if you ever do take the tarp out when you're backpacking, you can use your trekking poles to set up a variety of different types of pitches with the tarp. So.
Awesome. Yeah. I'll have to take note of that. I know, I've definitely played around with structures. I just enjoy playing with guy lines at rope. If you ever got time to kill it, kind of taking the pack off and just kind of messing around for lunch, and definitely played around with random guy line structures, but yeah, I haven't formally set anything up and slept under it outside of using my bike.
Okay. Now how about a sleeping bag or a quilt?
I've never tried a quilt, except car camping, I guess, but that doesn't really count for the adventure folks. That's more like the night before you wake up and have those early morning calls. So I'm a sleeping bag all the way right now.
Okay. A mummy bag or?
Yeah. Mummy bag.
Mummy bag. Okay. Mm-hmm. Here's one that's going to help me determine your level of sanity. Stove, cold soak or stoveless?
Ooh, I generally stove it. Yeah. Actually almost 100% stove.
Okay.
I can see how that would test the sanity levels. I haven't quite gotten into cold soak yet. I have done multi-days on just Clif Bars and actually Costco mango slices and gummy bears. That's my holy trinity of snacks is just some sort of protein bar and then mango slices and gummy bears. That's pretty much the closest I've gotten to maybe a cold soak. It's not quite a real meal, if you will, but I don't know how much of those, you know, cold soak folks are really getting. I mean, maybe you're getting a full meal's worth. I haven't really dove in too deep into that pool yet.
Yeah, unless you're soaking the bars and the mango in a jar full of water, it's not. It wouldn't be cold soak. That's stoveless. And
that's stoveless. Yeah,
stoveless. Yeah, and your description of the holy trinity of snacks. I love that. That's fantastic.
Oh, so yeah. Then I guess it's mostly stove or stoveless. There's no. I haven't tried the cold soak yet.
Okay. And if you were to hike a long trail like the PCT, the CDT, or the AT, should it be hiked northbound or southbound?
I generally think southbound is the way I would approach it. I think trying to get through the mountains, or at least here's my I guess reasoning right now is like trying to get the elevation out of the way and then flattening out and just going for those miles on the back end make sense. Also, I think it's more predictable from the seasons, but I could be totally off there based on weather and how people maybe flip that to get into some more rainy territories or escape the rain, depending on when they start. So I think the elevation and the weather are the two biggest factors I'd say that apply for me thinking going southbound is the right move.
Okay. Now some of my listeners are going to disagree with me, but you were going so well until that question. So I kind of took you down on the scale.
Oh no.
I'm going to give you an 83. Solid score.
Right. Okay. So not quite too crazy.
Not quite too crazy. Just, you know, getting closer. Yeah. All right. Very good. Hey, before we get too far down the trail, let's back up a little bit. And we'd love to hear about your background, kind of your origin story, where you grew up. Did you play any sports and hobbies in high school, and how you got involved in the outdoor adventure cult?
Yeah. So I grew up in Southern California, pretty close to a beach. And so was just always going to the beach with friends. I actually had this tree in my backyard. So before going to the beach and getting the driver's license and all that, I spent many, many days in my backyard with my brothers. I've got two brothers, and we would just play in the tree. We loved climbing, all sorts of gymnastics. We've got a trampoline too. So just kind of spent a lot of time as like what I considered the like childish, innocent fun of just being outside. And that's, I really associated a lot of that, I don't know, kind of escape after any sort of stress or homework. I'd go outside, just like still try and plant the tree when I was probably way too old to be up in that thing. But then I started getting into hammocking. And so I'd read the book and string up a hammock in the tree. I started swimming and playing water polo all through high school. Didn't carry too much of that into college, but I also grew up mountain biking a bit. So was all through Laguna Canyon and kind of the canyons down in Southern Orange County. Got introduced to backpacking though, I think when I was 15 or 16 with a church group. We had gone to, or we were going into Inyo Forest, and we're trying to, I forgot what mountain it was now. I don't even remember what highways, you know, too young to kind of remember some of that stuff, but I remember getting most of the way up and then, someone actually had gotten altitude sickness. And so he wasn't feeling so hot. And so like, I volunteered to stay with him while the rest of the group had finished that summit. I remember being so torn up, like coming back with this guy. We, you know, didn't want to leave him alone, obviously. And like the chaperones were going with the majority of the group. So we went back to camp, and I remember the guys came back and they were just so amped about, you know, bagging the peak or whatever the mountain we were close to was at the time.
Hang on a second, Kevin. One of the chaperones didn't stay behind with the guy. They made another camper stay behind with the guy.
Yeah, I went back with the guy. He was like, yeah, I'll just go back. And so I ended up, it was just me and him. I had no idea what I was doing or looking after this guy. He was just like, yeah, just go down some elevation. You'll be fine. So
the chaperones wanted a peak bag. I said, I'm not missing this opportunity. Let's put Kevin on this guy.
That's what it seemed like. At the time, I was like, you know, we're just all being friendly and, you know, I'll come back. But I just remember them getting back and I was a little upset. You know, I was like, dang, I
absolutely
didn't get that shot. And that's really one of the first times. And I was just so stoked to be out in, like, you know, in the backcountry. And the other thing, we cooked, we had prepped potatoes in foil and just like made the campfire and then stashed them in the ashes or stashed them in like the hearth of the fire and cooked up on dinner that way. And that was the first time I'd had like a meal like that, kind of like that wild. But it was such a good baked potato that night. I remember just being stoked you could cook food that way. I was like, why don't we play with fire more often?
Wait a second, you can cook without microwaves?
Yeah, right. It was mind-blowing. Needless to say, I did sign up for another hiking trip with them. This time it wasn't up in the mountains. We went down the PCH and ended up camping on the beach. But it was actually a bike trip with a caravan. So didn't have to carry weight. It was my first 50 miler and got a chance to go down, do, you know, 25 miles from home and 25 miles back. But that was a fun overnight as well, and kind of the same group there.
And you mentioned some brothers. Do they also have your same love for outdoor adventure?
So yes and no. I think they have that same love for exploration. You know, younger brother does a lot of international traveling, you know, the one bag and kind of get up and go. So gifted with a camera. It's amazing. And then the older brother has actually worked for the Trust Republic Land for a bit. And has done some conservation work. and is looking for kind of planning work up in the PNW area. But he's done a lot of, he's done a lot of, like, I guess, smaller backpacking stuff. He used to live outside East LA and has, you know, done a lot of the mountains and regions there. We used to do this New Year's trip actually for about 5 or 6 years where, you know, wherever we were, I would fly down to him or he'd come up to me and we would just kind of spend New Year's together going off and finding some BLM land and camping wherever. It wasn't the hardcore like backpacking type stuff, but it was car camping. It was family time. And we got a chance to just, you know, explore new areas together. And I think Kelso Sand Dunes was a really cool trip for us. 1 year we ended up camping in like the high desert. It was supposed to, I guess, it was like a 20% chance of 0.5 inches of rain. Ended up snowing on us that night. We were not prepared for that at all. So I just remember waking up to like the whoosh, whoosh, whoosh sound from outside the tent. And I was like, what is going on? I'm like rolling over. Everyone looks like they're missing flags, but you know, it's dark. And so I get outside and expecting to like have to fight something off. And it's my brother with a broom sweeping the snow off. Woke up, it was like, I don't know, 3 or 4 in the morning, and we just tried to like pack up the camp a bit, make it snowproofed, and then just stayed up and watched the sunrise. It's kind of a nice little memory I have with my brother camping.
Yeah, BLM land, Bureau of Land Management, with many of the trails, especially in California, many of the trails you need permits. Mm-hmm. And you've got to, you know, sign up 6 months in advance and try and get on there right at the right time online to get that permit and get your reservation so you can hike during a certain time of the year. But with BLM, there is not a permit process. It's open to the public. You can camp wherever you want, right?
Yep. Yeah, that's exactly right. Mm-hmm. You know, there's some rules and regulations around how to use the space and how to use the space space in a way that's, you know, for the public. But yeah, I would say if you're looking for like the non-permit, a little more isolated type land, I mean, you're not going to have the same types of like features like a Yosemite Valley would, but I do think there's a lot of awesome protected land, especially up on the kind of east coast or east border of California. That's a lot of just what kind of preserved BLM land that's makes for some really awesome weekend adventures if you're willing to go out and kind of rough it and find that stuff for yourself, because it's definitely less traveled.
Yeah, I think our listeners, the people who listen to this podcast, they're up for that adventure. You know, they love roughing it. So that's a great suggestion. Now, you mentioned you grew up in Southern Orange County. You talking Mission Viejo area?
Kind of. Laguna Niguel, actually.
Laguna Niguel.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, played Mission Viejo High School in a lot of water polo matches. Those were
the Diablos.
Fun. Yep. Yeah.
What was Laguna Niguel? What was their mascot?
The high school is called Aliso Niguel because it's a blend of Aliso Viejo and Laguna Niguel, and we were the Wolverines. Wolverines. Yeah.
All right. And did you prevail in most of the contests against the Diablos?
Oh, from what I remember, they were generally, no, I'd say we were pretty even, if not, they were better at water polo. And I think we were better at swimming, but I could be misremembering that. I remember Capo used to wreck us, but Tesoro was our true rival, and that was the Coda de Casa kids. Their high school was built after ours, but a mirror image of ours, so we always thought they just copied us and moved out to the canyon. but yeah, that was always the game of the year. The water polo game of the year was against the Tesoro kids.
Yeah, Capistrano, they're an aquatic powerhouse, from what I've heard.
It's impressive. I don't know what's in their water 40 minutes up the coast, but something's different, and it's impressive.
All right. Hey, and what are you doing these days to pay the bills and fund your adventures?
I work for a tech startup right now. We're an immigration legal tech startup, and I'm doing revenue operations. So like go-to-market strategy and business analytics. It's definitely paying the bills. It's fun. It's honestly a really, really fun company to be a part of. Pretty early stage startup. We're around 30 people, so get to wear a number of hats, which keeps me definitely intellectually stimulated. With every day is something different, right? Whether it's sales operations or sales strategy or starting to play with more on the marketing and demand gen side. It's kind of an interesting little niche to then I think at times forces my hand to say, okay, I need to unplug for a bit and go on some bigger adventures and just forget about my laptop for a bit.
If it's intellectually stimulating, that's code words for you're working your tail off.
A little bit. Yeah. There are definitely some nights that are a little long. But I do think like the mission of the company is such that I feel really good about it. You know, it's a really interesting problem. When you start to dive into like what we're trying to solve for and just kind of help make immigration a little bit easier for folks. So, it's worth it, I think, at the end of the day.
Very good. And where are you located? Are you in Boulder, I think? Boulder, Colorado?
I'm actually in San Francisco. So I'm based out of the Bay
Area. San Francisco. Why did I think Boulder? Do you have some Boulder on your timeline?
I have a little bit of Boulder. Yeah, I've got a friend out there. Shout out to Maggie. We've been maybe thinking about planning a Boulder backpacking trip. She actually just bought a gravel bike. So I'm pretty excited for her there. We're maybe going to get some gravel riding in the next time I visit. But I can't think of any bad thing to say about Boulder. I think it's a wonderful spot.
Yeah. If you can't be in California with all of the outdoor adventure possibilities here, Boulder's not a bad place to be either.
Not a bad place to stop. Yep. I agree.
Okay. Now, earlier on, you mentioned the Lost Coast. I didn't see that on our list of discussion points, but I want to hit on it because I have considered doing the Lost Coast. I've done a lot of research on the Lost Coast over mm-hmm. the years, and it just sounds like an incredible experience. How long ago did you do that?
We did it I'm laughing because it was the start of the pandemic. So I think it was either February or I think it might've been mid-February of 2020. And I remember specifically we were going into the weekend and COVID was on the news in China at the time. And the world was kind of starting to get a little anxious about what was going to happen. I remember we were like, okay, we're going into 3 days of no service. Like who knows what we'll end up escaping on the other side of it. And the joke is we were ending at Shelter Cove. All right. That's one of the areas where you pop out on the northern section of the Lost Coast. We're like, should we just shelter in Cove? Like, should we stay here at Shelter in Place? Was kind of the mandate coming out at the time. And like, should we just shelter in Cove? And you know, we unfortunately made the decision to go back to SF, which I think was the safe and smart move. But it was kind of funny for a bit to entertain the idea of just living out on the Lost Coast and finding some rations and figuring it out.
Yeah, there are so many times in the last 5 years where you go out on the trail and you're in incommunicado with the entire world, and you're wondering, you know, when I come back out, is my phone just going to blow up with some huge piece of earth-shattering news or not? I remember that feeling vividly. You know, just what is going on while I'm out of touch with everybody else.
Yeah, and it seems like, you know, you go out for a few weeks, come back, there's a new variant, and I just remember doing that once or twice. Like, oh damn, like what mutation is gonna happen now? Like, when do we get zombies coming out of this? And this, I want to turn my phone off airplane mode? Do I really want to know what's going on in the world right now? But unfortunately, it always kind of ends up, you got to come back at some point.
Yeah. Now let's, for our listeners out there who may not be familiar with the Lost Coast Trail, let's fill them in. This is on the coast of Northern California. Mm-hmm. And there was a highway. Was it Highway 1 that was going to be extended along the coast there? And they eventually decided it was too rugged, it was too rough, and they gave up on it. But there's this kind of abandoned, in some places, highway, but this is the basis for the trail, the Lost Coast Trail.
Yeah, so there's like a north and south section, from what I understand, out by Humboldt County. And they effectively were trying to make the one go all the way up the coast as much as they could hug the coastline as possible. And this is the only section where they really deemed it really just too rugged to be able to build any sort of really long-standing structure there. So they decided to pull it inland. So you'd end up with, I think it's like 30 miles or a little bit longer than 30 miles or so of just this pristine untouched coastline that kind of tucks behind, I don't know if I'd call it a range, but it's at least like a pretty steep hill, or a pretty steep hilly section that, is just beautiful untouched beach. One of the interesting things that I think this trail provides specifically, or the coastline, is that there are certain impassable zones that make it a little more fun and challenging. Because if you don't time the tides right, you know, there's reports of people being sucked out by the tide. But generally, I think, you know, if you use your brain, you see that the pass is covered. You shouldn't try and, you know, run past a long section of the beach unprotected. So, timing the tides was definitely another added fun element. For one of my friends, it was one of his like first or second backpacking trips. And he was like, what's this time thing that we have to do? Like, what does that mean if we don't make it? Like, what is impassable? And he was like, yeah, a little more in his head about it. I wouldn't say this is a beginner backpacking trip by any means, especially a point A to point B hike and with cars and shuttling. But it's quite awesome. There's lots of mixed terrain too.
Yeah, you definitely need to know the tide times, high tide, low tide, before you go. And if you don't know them, if you get to a part that's impassable, if the water is coming up so far that you can't get through, well, that's where you're camping for the near term until the tides recede a little bit so you can get across.
Exactly. Yeah.
Now, one of the two topics that people talk about on the trail, any trail, is food and bodily functions. So we're gonna venture into bodily functions here just for a second on the Lost Coast, because I think in my research for the Lost Coast, one of the things they recommended was that you doing your business down below, close to the water
line.
Yeah, the water line. Is that true? Is that accurate?
I actually don't remember, and I don't know if I was just like trying to black this out or I just didn't. I just held it in all trip. I don't remember.
There's your trail name, Prairie Dog.
That's I guess a good one. I think we did end up bringing like those little, you know, poop shovels and things, but I can't remember sneaking away and using it over the 2 days.
It seems counterintuitive to me that they would want you to poop at the water line. It goes against everything that I've ever heard about going to the beach or, you know, staying away from a water source when you're doing your business. But right. I remember reading that in the guidance for the Lost Coast Trail.
Yeah, I guess if it's like, you know, it's not contaminating the water source such that the ocean won't backflow up into the streams. You know, you're talking about the mecca of all water sources at that point. And there's probably worse stuff in that ocean that's coming up and down, as long as it's not, I guess, rolling back onto shore and you're burying it a bit.
You gotta dig a hole. You gotta dig a hole right at the waterline and do your business. Which also, you know, there's not a lot of trees to hide behind when you're doing that, so that you're pretty exposed.
There's not a lot of sneaky places to hide on that trail. Like it was a straight shot beach line pretty much most of the way. Which was awesome because, you know, you can't really get lost per se. If you lose the group, you just keep the ocean on the right and follow the coastline. So I felt good about bringing my friend on there, cause like, dude, there's no way you get lost. You just walk along the water. But yeah, there's not much, much privacy unless you can find one of the bluffs and find one of the like foot trails that'll sneak you up. I think we camped one of the nights up on a bluff, and it was quite scenic waking up, looking at the ocean and we had thought it was going to rain that day. So we were prepared for full rain all Saturday. And luckily the forecast was wrong and it rained overnight. So we woke up with like that fresh, nice rain, like, you know, I don't know what the clouds are, but like the really kind of fluffy cumulus that had just blown over past the rain, clear blue skies after expecting us to like wake up in this like stormy weather. And we're just pleasantly surprised to see just this perfect crystal Pacific Ocean and blue skies. And we woke up and, you know, no clouds on the horizon. So that was definitely a highlight of the morning, and it ended up just being an epic day.
Yeah. Beach camping is pretty epic in itself. I know that, you know, I've done the Trans Catalina Trail a couple of times, and Parsons Landing, you know, it's on the beach. And that was one of my favorite nights of hiking, just because of the, you know, the oceanal waves and seeing the mainland from Parsons Beach, the lights in Long Beach and San Pedro, ranks right up there with one of my top campsites ever. So,
I haven't actually camped on Catalina, but that's on the list for me. Falling asleep to the waves is such, or just running water in general, if you get a chance to camp somewhat close to those streams or rivers are next to you. I think those are just such pleasant ways to fall asleep.
Yep. All right. Hey, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to hear some more hiking stories and get into some biking stories as well. You've got some extensive biking experience we want to hear about. So stay tuned for that. We'll be right back.
From the backcountry to the backyard, we believe everyone deserves the highest level of protection. Since 1984, Sawyer Products offers the best, most technologically advanced solutions for protection against sun, bugs, and water, using time-released liposome technology, topical insect repellents, and new standards in water filtration. And with every Sawyer product you buy, you are helping to provide clean water through 140 charities in 80 countries with their long-lasting water filters. Every Sawyer product you buy is an investment in our common humanity. Choose Sawyer and keep the adventure going, knowing that their products have been tested and chosen by those who count on serious protection on the trail all day long.
The John Freakin' Muir Pod is sponsored by Outdoor Vitals, the ultralight backpacking gear company whose mission is to improve the mental, physical, and emotional health of mankind by facilitating impactful outdoor experiences. Outdoor Vitals creates innovative technical products with confidence-inspiring education that empower outdoor ultralight adventurers. Their focus on performance enables you to live ultralight with gear you can actually be confident with. Whether you're looking for an ultralight sleep system, shelter, or pack, or if you're looking for top-quality apparel for the trail, you can find it at Outdoor Vitals. Do yourself a favor. Live ultra light. And welcome back. We're talking to Kevin Gong about his backpacking experiences, as well as some upcoming bikepacking experiences here. And we left talking about the Lost Coast. What other types of backpacking experiences have you had out there? I know that on the outline here, I see Trinity Alps. Have you spent some time in the Trinity Alps?
Yeah, Trinity Alps is a good one. I've definitely spent a little bit of time, I'd say. Not a lot, and definitely want to go back for more. This trip was quite a lot of planning, trying to figure out, I've had multiple friends recommend this area to me as something that's, a little less trafficked, a little harder to get to, right? It's up by past Reading. So my area, it's 5-6 hour drive just to get out there. A little less populous and a little less signage as well. So the trails sometimes, depending on where you're trying to go, there's not much of a trail depending on the season. So you're kind of like bushwhacking, or if you lose a trail, you're just, GPS and compass and map are trying to figure out somehow.
That's always a little exciting when there's not enough signage and the trail kind of disappears on you.
Yeah. Yeah. We were really looking forward to it. I think the way we're trying to go, I think was it China Camp or Grizzly Gulch, to China Lake or something. I can't remember the exact route now, or the exact trail route now, because we never actually got to it. And that's part of the fun story there. So we had taken the day off and planned to drive up. We worked half days, drove up. So it's now like 11 or something. And we're, deep into this car ride, well past snacks, well past like the top hits in the playlists. It's starting to get into just whatever you got downloaded on your Spotify or whatever. And we're trying to figure out, we're, I think, on a forest road, almost at the point where we're turning off onto like the road for the trailhead. And we heard this just sudden pop, and hit a sharp rock in my friend's car and rolled on it for a bit. The low pressure light went on, but we're like, oh, it's fine. Kept rolling on it for a little bit longer because we were less than 2 miles from the trailhead. And we're like, no, we should look, because we're on this single lane fire road, middle of the night now, and we haven't seen a car in hours. And we're just out there. So we're like, okay, this doesn't feel right. Like, everyone was kind of looking at each other, like seeing how comfortable it was, because we had just driven so far already to go on this epic adventure for the weekend. But no, unfortunately, flat tire. So everyone was looking around. Who's changed a tire before? Anyone? No one. Like, none of us had changed a tire. I had kind of knew how to do it. So, change out the alternating lug nuts and take the wheel off. We luckily had the spare in the back, but now we're on a donut. We're on a forest road. which isn't well groomed to begin with up in Trinity Alps. But we're a mile away from this trailhead. So we're like, well, like, what's the risk? What's the pros, cons? Talked it out over our tire fire is what we called it. We had put the tire, the flat one, in the middle and just set up our chairs around it as if it was a fire in the middle of this forest road because we had nowhere else to go. Had put the donut on and we're like, we're just gonna sleep here and figure it out in the morning. And so we came to the realization though that we should probably turn back, which then meant two nights worth of food and shenanigans could be consumed in one night. And so we just, you know, got to town on the beers and whiskey and ate all the camping food we wanted and snacked and then, you know, kind of just hung out, went to bed, woke up in the morning, drove really, really slowly on that donut on the way out, saw no other cars. Yeah, we had to retreat quite a bit, but we ended up going on a different hike in the area to some lakes. So kind of salvaged the day, found another alpine lake to swim in, which ended up being a really cool hike, but definitely want to go back to Trinity Alps to find that trail again.
So you were a mile away from the trailhead and you guys decided to turn around and drive back? You'd have to drive back anyway, right? I mean, if you go one mile further, do the hike and you come out, you have to drive back anyway, right?
We had to drive back anyway, but the tire was what we were most concerned about because we eventually had to get home. And we knew that donut would not take us home, nor did we know any mechanics in the air. We didn't have service. And so we were just like, let's just get on a road and pick a direction. I think it's what, like 50 miles is like not the warranty limit, but like what they advise. So we're like, we don't even know within 50 miles what we're going to find. And we would have rather figured that out on Saturday than having to do it Sunday or Monday, because it was a pretty long trek that we were planning. I think we were planning for a Monday return and, we're just not willing to risk it at that point. So ended up on the donut. That was a fun experience. And we'd all have like, was this tire hold up? Like no one changed his tire. They were all blind faith in me. And, you know, luckily I think I figured it out just fine. So we got out of there and the mechanic, actually, I wish I had the mechanic shop because they changed it, patched the tire for us, didn't charge us anything and said, you're welcome. Like just go have on your day, like be on your way. It's no charge to us at all. Like enjoy.
Too bad we can't recognize them here on the pod.
Yeah, let me see if I can maybe find it, but I just can't recall. It was just such a random little town. I mean, we picked left, like that was the way we found this. It was on a shop. We're like left or right on the main road, left, let's go. And just ended up finding this tire, this mechanic.
And what shape was the donut tire in when you showed up to the mechanic shop?
I think it was all right. I don't, you know, I don't have too much exposure with donuts, which I think is all right. I think it was fine. Oh, Valley Tire and Tackle. There we go. Out of Fort Jones, California, Valley Tire and Tackle. Those guys are great.
All right. Shout out to those guys. Nice job. Now, I think you should always follow the written instructions on how to handle driving on a donut tire, of course, speed limit and distance and all of that. But we did have a previous guest who talked about he was on a trip and he was in a similar situation where he was out in the middle of nowhere and he was almost there and got a flat tire. And the tire was actually, the lug nuts were rusted. He went to sleep. He said, he did just like you guys. I'm just going to sleep on it. I'm not going to worry about it. I'm not even going to look at it. And he got up the next morning and had to use a rock to beat on the rim to loosen the lug nuts. Eventually he was able to get them off and he put the donut on and he says, you know what? I'm almost here. I'm just going to go for it. And so he did his hike. He came back and he drove like 300 miles on this. Maybe it wasn't 300 miles, but it was something ridiculous.
Significant.
200 miles at least on this donut out in the middle of nowhere on rough, rough roads. And he made it back. So, the written instructions are going to tell you, what you should do, but there's a little bit of extra in there, I think. So
there always is that little bit of extra. That's like when gas tanks tell you they're empty and they still got 20 miles. You can sometimes get away with it. You know, you're like, yeah, I know my car well enough. I can get another 20 out of this.
Yeah. Am I going downhill? Am I downwind? Yeah. We'll go a little bit further. Next gas station for sure.
I did that in Yosemite. Actually, I was out of fuel and was just driving in neutral on all the downhills. Just coasting and hoping to get to a gas station, which ended up working out. But I don't know if that's a myth to be busted or not, but if someone out there knows, I'd love to know if pulling it into neutral when you're coasting downhill, if that saves gas or not.
So we drove through Utah. This reminds me of a story. We drove through Utah on the way to, this is a family of five. It's me and my wife, my three kids, who are all little at this point, and we're driving out to Colorado from California for a baseball tournament that my son's team had qualified for. And so we left Arches. We hiked in Arches, and we left Arches, and we got on the road, and I didn't realize what our gas situation was. Didn't think to look. I guess I was just so stoked about, you know, the hiking in Arches.
Baseball, yeah.
And baseball. Yeah, right. So I pass a sign and it says, you know, next service, I don't know, 90 something miles, 100 something miles. And I look down and I've got like nowhere near that. And so we're dry. The smart thing, of course, in hindsight, it's always 20/20. The smart thing would be to stop, turn around and go back the 20 miles to the town that had the gas station that you just came from. Right. Mm-hmm. But no, I'm thinking, you know, we're going to try and make it. And so I remember drafting. I call it drafting. I was right behind a big rig, you know, trying to have the big rig push the air and just suck me along behind it to, you know, conserve as much gas as possible, and end up rolling off the off ramp into the town of Fruta. And there's a gas station right there, but it was touch or go. It was very stressful in the car, of course, with three kids and everything else going on, but it was crazy.
Yeah, that's when you wish they weren't paying attention to how you were driving, right? You wish they were causing commotion in the backseat, but no, everyone's watching you at that point, I'm sure. Yeah.
My wife says, "Why are you tailgating?" I said, "I'm not tailgating, I'm drafting."
Yeah, drafting. Actually, if we get into some of the biking stuff, I've definitely drafted quite a bit off folks, and, you know, different version of gas versus energy conservation when it coming from human powered, but, you know, drafting, tailgating, whatever you want to call it, it works.
Yeah, and there was a town before Fruta that I got off the freeway, and I was looking for a gas station. There was a gas station there, but it was closed. It was boarded up, you know, out of business, and end up in a neighborhood. And I see these people kind of on the front porch, and, you know, I motioned to them. I want to ask them, where is the closest gas station? And I'm idling on fumes, right? I mean, there's gotta be nothing left. And this guy sees me, and he comes walking down from the porch, and he is walking very slowly. And I'm like, "Oh man, you gotta hurry up, man. I'm in a situation here." And he talked just as slow as he walked. And so it was not the city lifestyle. It was all very take your time. And I was cursing the whole time, getting back on the on ramp and the highway, and thinking about how much gas I'm using to get back up to speed here. But it all worked out. It's a good story. Type 2 fun.
Definitely some type 2 fun there.
Yeah. All right. Now, have you spent any time in the Sierras?
I've done a little bit of Tahoe, but not much in like outside of Yosemite, like backcountry, or I guess in Kings and Inyo or Sierras. I've done Whitney though. I guess that definitely counts as the Sierras.
That definitely,
right?
Counts. Yes.
Yeah. So we did,
Yeah, I was gonna say, and it's not just any old hill in the Sierras. I mean, it's Whitney that you've done. That's the big boy.
It was a big boy. Yeah, it was definitely one of those like COVID, should we do it, should we not, scenarios. But ended up all the permits and permit lottery stuff worked out, and so we just said we're doing this. And I was like, are we trained for this? Do we need training for this? You know, all those questions you're thinking about. Wait, this is what? What mound again? The lowest, the tallest in the lower 48. Oh, okay, great. Yeah, it sounds like a cakewalk, right? But luckily, a friend Jackie and me had kind of started planning this thing out and started rallying our crew together. And yeah, we planned for first night out Alabama Hills. So BLM land right in the base of off the 395 there. Gorgeous campsite. I love that campsite so much. And then yeah, the next day went up Whitney Portal, packed it in. We went the mountaineering route. We also went in the summer, so there wasn't ice, which was in that, well, there's ice at the end, and that's for a different, that's for later in the story. But there wasn't supposed to be too much ice. And yeah, it's, I think it's 8 miles, around 8 miles round trip or so. And it's up to 14. So you start Whitney Portal around 8,000, just all of a sudden you're pretty much doing a stair stepper all the way up.
and pretty steep. I mean, are there ropes in place in some sections?
No, there's no ropes. You kind of think there should be in certain sections, actually. There are two sections I'd say got pretty dicey. One specifically are these, the section of the hike called the ledges. And it's really interesting because a lot of the notes, if you do enough research, you feel very comfortable on the approach. But looking at these things, it's just three ledges. That's really what it is. And you have to climb up through a tree is pretty much how you get to the first one. You're like hugging up against the brush on one side, climbing up through a tree. I think two of the folks took backpacks off and tried to pass it up on the way up or on the way down. Man, that section was dicey though, because you're just trying to find the next line, trying to find where to pull yourself up. And you've got this pack weighing you backwards. So, you know, that if you fall backwards, that's, you know, you're falling a significant distance there. That's the three different ledges we had to climb up and over. And then we camped at Iceberg Lake the first night. And that's around 12,000, or I guess this is the second night of the trip now. So around 12,000. And Boy Scout Lake, sorry, that was around 10, and then we got up to Iceberg, which is 12, and then the final push was the 14. So Boy Scout Lake, we're getting up there, my friend starts developing signs of altitude sickness, and you know, she just not looking great. And so we like stop for a lunch break, and we're trying to get water, fluids, the works. Meanwhile, she's just slowly curling up into a ball, and it's not looking pretty. And she's always been one that really appreciates maps and directions and planning. Like that's her thing when we plan trips. Like I'll double check for food and a few other pieces of first aid, carry the extra gear. Her thing's directions. She loves maps. And I just remember this moment so vividly where she's like not looking great. She reaches down in her pack, pulls out the map and gives it to me. And I was just like, oh no, like this is bad. Like she never wants to give this map up. And, her and her boyfriend were assessing the situation. They're like, you three go up ahead. You guys can go up. We'll make it if we can. If not, we're going to go back. And I just like, such like a big heavy weight. I was like, oh damn, am I trip leader now? Do I have to figure out the directions? And yeah, that was a big thing. We got up to Boy Scout. We got for a nice little cold soak. Ended up eating dinner in probably one of the most epic views I've ever seen, with Whitney in the background, some of the spires, the lake right in front of us, and then looking behind, it's just this massive granite valley right over Death Valley. So it was just such a cool view. And they made it up for dinner, which was awesome. They, you know, she started feeling better, got acclimated, and so we had dinner together, and someone had made massive stone like Adirondack chairs. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right, but had made those like reclining chairs out of like, oh, it felt like 6-foot slabs of just massive granite pieces. They had stacked all perfectly, and so we just sat around this little ring eating dinner and shooting the shit. And
it's probably ancient aliens probably did that.
Building crop circles and things. Definitely the most scenic place I've ever had to do my business too, just crawling up into the rocks, doing a little wag bag and bringing it back. That was an interesting experience with the wag bags.
That is the thing about hiking in the Sierras. I mean, you have no better bathroom views than when you're in the Sierras. They're epic.
It was epic. Yeah, I'll have to I'll see if we can share a photo after this with that view too. I just remember being just so awestruck. I was like, I don't want to be on my phone at all, but I was like, but I do need a photo of this. I do need one photo of this.
And you knew that when she handed you the map that she was in bad shape, because that ordinarily would never happen.
Yeah. Her passing the map is a big deal. Like this is almost I don't want to call it a tick, but it's like whenever we're stopping for water or snacks, it's like, let's pull up the map and just like assess it. And I love it. It's so cool. Definitely rely on her a lot for navigation if we ever need it. But it is awesome that she has this really cool collection of maps that she's starting to build up of all the places she's been. And, you know, luckily, fortunate enough to have a solid hiking partner where I can just trust that's what she's bringing to the table all the time. Is just, we'll never get lost, which is great. So the last day we're getting up to Iceberg Lake. We've 5:30 a.m. start, I think 4:30 start. wake up, do a quick breakfast, leave the packs in my tent, open the tent up for all the marmots, unzip everything, right? That's like kind of what they tell you, is like, they're going to go through your pack, whether they eat through it or you just leave it open for them, you pick. So we like unzipped everything, packs and tape packs, helmets, spikes, and started climbing up. And we're getting up to the section that is right above Iceberg, where it climbs into this really steep ravine. I think it's called the final 400 or so. And what normally in the winter is iced over, where you can just kind of hike your way up it with crampons, it's just this massive scree field. And so you're just really trying to slug along. And two of my friends were not super comfortable bouldering. So they were already just like a little iffy being up there. And then the other two from the day before, the girl again started getting that altitude kind of lightheaded. She's like, I don't want to approach this. I'm not feeling well or not feeling strong, which I think was the smart move at the time. And so slowly our numbers are dwindling as we're getting closer to the summit. And I'm starting to make interesting decisions, or I'm like, do we keep going? Do we not? Like, you're starting to question this, because like Trinity again, we're so close to an awesome adventure, but it's right out of our reach. And so, we were still early enough on the approach. Four of the five were gone. And we get to this passover point. I forgot what the actual, there's a technical name for it. It's like the nose or something that you like have to pass through, or like the wedge maybe. And then you start climbing onto the backside and up and around to the actual peak. And so we get to that point, and it's a technical scramble. I think it was a class 3, class 4 scramble. And my friends just like, dude, I'm out. Like, I don't feel good about this. I'm going to start down climbing. And I was like, okay, well, like, what's the time now? How long do I think I need to get up there and back? Do I go alone? And end up making the decision that I feel strong enough. I've got everything I need. And I can figure it out. And we had seen a few people coming up and down, so I knew I wasn't totally remote. So I made the call to just kind of push on. And I'm starting to climb up the scree field, and I'm just jumping big rock to big rock, because it's, you know, with the hiking boots on, I'm getting all sorts of rocks all in my shoes at this point. And I'm just jumping up, sliding down. So it's total definition of one, like two steps forward, one step back, because I am just sliding back down. And I start trying to, in my mind, play Frogger, where I'm just trying to find the biggest stone that I can, jump on that and hope I don't slide. And I'm just kind of Froggering my way up to the top of this mountain. I get to the back section, and it's still iced over. And there were definitely, I didn't think at this point, which I should have taken more time to assess the approach. But I was like, I need to get up there. I feel good about where I'm at bouldering wise. I boulder on the side as well, and kind of doing fours and fives, nothing like crazy. Like, you know, that it's not, I guess it's not very, very strong and technical, but it's mid range where, you know,
it's not a 5.13. You got this.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, it's not any crazy boulder problems. So I'm getting up there, and I realize that I am way too far left on a certain section, and I need to cross all the way. I need to traverse effectively across to get up to where other folks were jumping up. I kind of was trying to read for the rocks that would make an easy approach. And I just started traversing and using this undercling of a rock that's hanging out there with like an icy slope on the bottom. And that's, you know, something I definitely don't tell my mom, where I'm like, oh yeah, you know, just underclinging across this ledge, get up to the top, run up. And it's like, run up, find the sign, grab a quick photo of the sign, just as like proof I made it. I'm already 30 or 20 minutes past like my turnaround time. But I like asked the guys, like, dude, it's blue skies. This you're already here. Like, you should just do it. So I'm now like hustling back. I like find the section that I was supposed to climb up down. So down climbing was a lot easier. And now I just start hopping down all the scree again. So rocks in the boots, and I'm just bouncing from rock to rock, like mountain goating my way down the hill. Eventually I get to a point, and they're kind of, I can see them just as little specks in the distance, sitting on the lake, like laying out on rocks, doing that. I do a quick little wave, and then I start, you know, making my way down. And that was the beginning of the descent. But I got a like very, very small moment of just like, yes, I made it up on top of that mountain before running back down. And so everyone was stoked, like that at least one of our group had made it up there. But then, yeah, once we got down, we actually had to drive back to San Francisco that night. So We got a very long day and got back, I think, after putting what effectively was like a 23-hour day in, got back at like 4 a.m. into the bay. And my other friends actually pulled something even crazier, where they were driving up to Hood River to go kite surfing. And so they were driving up, and they had to go through like the Oregon fires and things. It got gnarly for them. Like, they got in the morning. But that was quite a fun adventure for the Sierras. Definitely the highest, or most elated I've ever felt, kind of standing up on top of the mountain there.
Right. That's just a day trip, you know, 23 hours. That's a day trip. That's quite an adventure. Yeah. for one day. Fantastic.
Yeah, that was I guess you'd call it a day trip there. But yeah, no marmots chewed through our bags either. So that was also nice. But we had to go back, pack up the tent. Like, there was still so much we had to do descending. That was just like, I wish I had my hiking poles, and just trying to power along down descending, right?
Well, Kevin, don't let your mom listen to this episode.
Yeah, I'd be a little nervous. I've told her most of that story. I don't think she knows about the traversing part, but I generally bleep that part out to like to most folks. You know, it's one of those questionable decisions in hiking.
Okay. Now, you don't only have hiking experience, as we've talked about. You also have some biking experience, and you've biked most of the Oregon coast, and you've also biked from San Francisco to Santa Monica, which is down, for those folks who don't know, that's down by LA. So,
yep.
Tell us about some of those experiences, and what is your bike packing gear? How is that different from your backpacking gear?
Yeah, it's somewhat of a crossover, somewhat different. Bike packing and bike touring is a lot of dry bags and straps. Instead of having just like one vessel, you're really trying to just smash everything into as many little pockets and things you can. I think it's probably similar to the through hikes if you're doing an extended time, where day two you're like, do I really need this spaghetti that I packed? Nah, ditch. Do I really need this? Nah. And so you're kind of like this or that, and playing with weight at that point, because you just don't want to keep packing it back and forth. So yeah, I'd say from a gear perspective, I've only used panniers actually, which have held up pretty well. I haven't done any like more intense gravel on my bike packing. It's mostly, or I guess more so, been bike touring for those two trips, and then the gravel road, Fish Rock Road, which shall not be named. That was, I guess, the closest I got to some rough gravel on 28 slick road tires, which was not the right move. But yeah, generally I'd say beef your tires. You've got two Ortlieb panniers that are waterproofed. And then you have around like 40 liters or so to pack, or I guess 60 liters, including a dry bag that I strapped to the front of my handlebars, double bottle cage, mini or half frame bag for the frame, and then the two panniers that I just stuff everything else that I can. I generally try and pack one with like clothes, like sleeping gear, the works, the other with bike mechanic, food, the tent goes in there as well. So kind of a blend of like where I put my sleeping system, but I try and do like one as a camp bag and the other as like my day bag or anything else I need as a quick grab, lights, that sort of thing.
Right. Now, when you are biking from San Francisco to Los Angeles, where does one camp when you're in the middle of a bike trip like that?
It took a decent amount of research, and if anyone actually wants, like, hit me up on Instagram after. I'm happy to share what I made. California isn't as friendly as Oregon when it comes to, I guess, hike and bike type campsites and walk up campsites. So it's a little bit harder to plan for it, but I tried to use state land everywhere I could. I only got a hotel one night because it was like 35 mile an hour gusts. My gear was still wet from two nights before. And I just met some friends along the way that were credit card touring. So they offered, and I was like, you know, that sounds great. I could use a hot shower. It's been 4 days on the road. And I hadn't really gotten a proper shower besides the wipes. So that was a fun trip to plan, in that you kind of had to plan your segments very intentionally. My first segment was a little ambitious. I did 87 miles down to Santa Cruz. The next day was another 80 down to Big Sur. Then I did Big Sur the next day, and that's the day it rained on me, which was wild to do Big Sur in the elevation I was totally unprepared for. I was using Google Maps, which another fellow backpacker or bike tour laughed at me, literally laughed out loud. Was like, oh no. I was like, no. When I told him what my plan was for the day, because I was trying to get another 60 in that day over, I think it was like 6,000 or 7,000 feet of elevation, which was a haul of a day in the rain. So I camped outside Cambria, which was in San Luis Obispo area. Mm-hmm. Then outside of Goleta in Santa Barbara. And then there's a few parks outside of LA. And so I think it was Point Magoo Fort Harrison Park, which was kind of a cool little park. I didn't know that one existed right outside of LA, but it was that was actually one of my favorite campsites. Outside of Goleta, which I saw dolphins playing in the waves during sunset. So it's pretty hard to beat that.
You can't beat that.
Yeah, that one was, and it was just like, you know, the perfect Santa Barbara pink and blue skies. I mean, it was amazing. But those trips were, it's hard to plan, I think, because the parks websites also don't do a great job at labeling the hike or bike walk-up campsites. But they're like $5. It's like a total secret that I'm letting out right now. It's so cheap to camp that way. And a great way to explore your local roads as well. Like, you can stay relatively local, still get an epic adventure in, and do it for pretty cheap. And I mean, two of the guys that I found that were doing it, or one guy had panniers, the other guy was using a backpack, and wasn't the best. I don't think I wouldn't recommend that, but it's doable. That might be one of the insanity scale questions for you. If you're bike packing, do you use a backpack or panniers?
I'll have to amend the list. That's a good point. That's a fair point.
Yeah. That was a good trip. It was 7 days. I told my dad I was coming home for Thanksgiving, and I biked home. So that was a fun surprise. And I was like, hey, like, what's up? Rolling in. He's like, can you pick me up from Santa Monica area? I'm on my bike. And he's like, just so flabbergasted that I was able to pull that off.
I'm going to put you on the spot, Kevin. Do you prefer backpacking or bike touring?
Ooh. There's a different sense of adventure that I feel like I get between the two. In that with touring, there's such a thrill in actually riding a bike and having the wind in your face and covering so much ground. And still, it can be quite a feat depending on the distance, I'd say, you're going. But backpacking, I mean, it's just you and your feet and like the gear you've got on your back. And it's incredibly they're both incredibly human powered, self-supported adventures. But I think backpacking is more approachable, and you can get into some more interesting terrain, I'd say. Like, you don't need trails or any sort of, like, you can just go and hike wherever your feet can take you and climb over boulders or, you know, traverse icy ledges or wander down the beach. Like, it's really hard to do that all on a bike or all on the same bike, right? You can fat tire bike. There's Chris Picard, I think, is a big adventure photographer, and he's done Iceland a couple times over the snow. Like, that's definitely on the list. But I think, you know, just given that, that's so hard. Yeah, I'd say bikepacking, just because I haven't done it as much. It's still so new, and there's still so much to see. I think the Dolomites are an area that are high on the list. And I mean, bikepacking or backpacking would be amazing in those Alps. But there's just so much to see.
Yeah, can you share a favorite memory from each experience? A backpacking favorite moment and a bikepacking or bike touring favorite moment. One that really stands out, if we haven't talked about it already.
Yeah. I'm trying to, so the bikepacking, or I guess let's start with the backpacking. I think backpacking was kind of funny. We were all sitting around sharing snacks outside of Alabama Hills with that group, kind of talking, Whitney in the background, looking at, you know, what our next 2 days would look like. And this little mouse come up, this little desert mouse came up and started like trying to nip for food, and was running back and forth. And we're like, where did this thing go? And we're now just like, you know, obviously not trying to like feed it, leave no trace policy and whatnot. But it ended up nipping my, or like, I guess taking a little nibble out of my friend's finger instead. Like ran up and just, I had crumbs on the finger or something, but that mouse knew what it wanted. And just like nipped my friend. And he was just so amazed that the wildlife could do that, right? We're worried about like, oh, bear canisters or any sorts of other things, but no, desert mouse got him. So that was a pretty funny little moment there. And then bike packing, this was the Oregon coast. And I had met another friend, Ian, on day one of the trip. So day three now, we were kind of doing a little bit of a brewery tour, and we ended up finding Rogue Brewing out of Newport, and our campsite was less than a mile and a half away, which is dangerous, very dangerous for a campsite to be that close to a brewery. And so we roll in, and he tries to avoid this little sand pit in the way. It's like there's like a space between the gates you can just roll through. And so we roll through, he avoids the sand pit, rolls over some weeds, and then rolls into and roll over to the brewery, and I'm like, dang, his tire is really sandy. Like, it's some weird stuff going on that tire. Get inside the brewery, get a little flight, do some tastings, come back out. It was not sand. It was really, really thorny vegetation that he had rolled through trying to avoid the sand. And so he was running a tubeless setup, which is just sealant. And we ended up spending, I think, an hour and 45 minutes, if not 2 hours, picking individual thorns out of his tire, because he didn't have an extra tire nor extra sealant. So if you're getting into bike packing and using tubeless, please bring both of those extra things. But went inside, grabbed another six pack. So we were like, all right, we're not doing the mileage we thought we were going to do that day. We're just going to sit down, hang out. And I had a credit card and he had tweezers, and we just flicked thorns out of the front and back tires for probably 2 hours sipping on beer.
Oh, darn. More beer. Sorry.
right. Yeah. I mean, we ended up, that led to a pretty great sunset actually, because we were going to skip one of the campsites. I think it was like Cape Perpetua or something. And the drop in is off the highway and then into this lagoon. And I just remember we rolled into this lagoon and the sunset just kind of had magically started forming through the forest, and we could see it as we were kind of biking through. But then when we hit the lagoon, it was just full force. And this heron comes from like the left side or the right side of your view and just swoops down onto the lake, while this person that's kayaking is kind of on there, like crystal clear waters, very still. And this heron just swoops super low and follows it all the way across the horizon and goes back up into the forest. And it was just such a treat. That was, I guess, how things work out sometimes. After the thorns and beers, we just ended up seeing this really cool sunset and rolling into camp at dark. And nice little hack about Oregon parks is that a lot of them are bike friendly and a lot of them offer hot showers for free. So that was huge. Nice. It was really fun to get the hot shower after a day like that. Although we were pretty relaxed, I'd say, from the afternoon.
Yeah, that's the way you described it. That sounds like a scene from a National Geographic documentary. Right.
In my head, I was narrating in the background. Yeah, I was hoping someone would narrate in the back. It was, oh man, that was, I think that's one of my highlights though, definitely of backpacking, is just like how still the evening felt for those few moments. And we didn't even stop for that long, but just for those few moments, we were just standing there silent, just watching this whole scene like unfold. It was amazing.
Fantastic. Hey Kevin, you know where we are?
I don't. Where are we?
We are at that time of the episode where I turn to you and ask you for some trail wisdom, for your pro tip insight of the week. What bit of advice do you have for our listeners to make their next outdoor adventure even better?
I think in terms of pro tips, what I've found is you can never hydrate too much. I know it's a super basic tip, but as someone who grew up kind of in the water, playing water polo, swimming, I kind of just like took the thirst feeling for granted. You know, it's kind of gross, but you swish and spit and you just keep on doing your sport, right? Whereas I think the dry land folks, if you will, the soccer players, football, whatever else, like you kind of feel thirsty, you got to go get some water. And so I didn't really actually develop a good habit of that until I think going through the Grand Canyon of Tuolumne, when I started realizing I was just getting so fatigued and I just wasn't drinking enough water. And so that was a huge thing for me, is actually stopping, taking the proper amount of water breaks. Same thing with cycling. You're just always expending energy. And so being hydrated will be a game changer, not only for just how long you can go in a day, but also for the next day and how quickly you recover. So that's, I know, super basic, but if you're going into the desert or going somewhere where you think there might be water sources, take the extra time to refill and get prepared.
That is a solid pro tip, not basic at all. So thank you for that. So there you have it. That's it. This episode is just about in the books. Hope our listeners enjoyed our time with Kevin. I want to thank him for joining us this week. Kevin, how can our listeners keep up with you on social media, and where can they find updates on your latest adventures?
I'm on Instagram mostly. I think that's the most posts I do on the adventure side. And that's K Gong with two G's at the end. Yeah, that's probably the best bet. And I love feedback on photos. So if anyone actually is starting to get into a hobbyist adventure photography type of sorts, I'm starting to get a group together to do some, just kind of talk through how we can improve in photo tips for outdoors. So follow me there.
Okay. Remember to check out the pod on social media as well. We are on Facebook, YouTube, Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok. And if you have comments or clips you want to share, you can send it to me at johnfreakingmuir@gmail.com. Kevin, I'm also looking to you to share a recommendation for a book, a movie, documentary, some kind of adventure media to keep our listeners connected to the outdoors. We call this our adventure media recommendation. What do you have for us?
Ooh, can I do two?
Absolutely. Two is better than the price of one. Yeah.
Valley Uprising. Was a climbing doc that I really loved. Mm-hmm. I think I watched it around the same time that like Don Wall and Free Solo came out, but I was like, what's this one? You know, Amazon's like, we got the algorithm for you. And they nailed me. It was amazing. So love that documentary. And then the other one I'd recommend, this is actually a book I'm kind of getting my way through, but Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance. It's not quite an adventure-esque book, but it's almost like a fable-esque, has the story of a guy riding his motorcycle across the states, and I don't want to give any more away, but if you're into motorcycle or philosophy, if that, for that matter, it's a kind of a nice little book. It's quite old, actually. I think it was published back in the 70s, but it's a good one.
You're right. You're right on that. It is from the 70s, and it's a interesting read. Very good. And Valley Uprising. I think Valley Uprising is the best example I can think of expectations determining what people are able to do. So it's actually a kind of a lesson in efficacy, because they thought that El Capitan could never be summited, right? That could never be climbed. And the first guy to do it, you know, it took him 18 months to do it. And then once he did it in 18 months, and people knew that it was possible to do it, you saw that time shorten and shorten and shorten and shorten until now they're doing it in, you know, 4 hours. So
yeah,
the elite climbers today.
That reminds me of, have you seen 14 Peaks yet?
Yes.
Nims, that's the same kind of thing, right? It's like, how quickly can you climb all those 14ers? And I mean, what was it, like years for the first one? And then now it's down to months or a few years. I can't remember the exact timeline, but
yeah, it was 7 months, right? It was 7 months that he did the 14 Peaks.
Yeah, that sounds right. Was it six or seven years down to 6 or 7 months or seven right. months? Yeah, amazing. It's truly inspiring.
Yes, absolutely. You know, I reached out to Nims, asked if he wanted to come on the podcast. I'm still waiting for a response, but you know, I'll keep my fingers crossed.
There we go. Share the episode, and let's see if we can get Nims on board. I'd love to hear him talk about how he got into adventures. I wonder what his pro tip is. That'd be a fun one.
That no oxygen tank. That's his pro tip.
Oh, there we go. Is that his gear rack as well? No oxygen tank.
All right. Hey, and before we wrap things up, I've got just one more segment for you called What Have I Not Asked You That You're Dying to Tell Us About? What do we miss?
Ooh, I know, like, going outside, being able to experience the outdoors, it comes from somewhat of a place of privilege, but just cherish it as much as you can. It is so cool that we have the opportunity that we do to experience nature and get out there. It's such a great way to reset the mind, or it really is kind of just this awesome healing force that provides when you go out and, you know, respect it and respect those trips. So I think whatever we can do from a conservation perspective or advocacy perspective to be better stewards for Mother Nature, I think we should definitely be doing our part where we can.
Yep. Take care of it for future generations to experience that same magic out there.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, that is a wrap from the John Freaking Muir studio. Any shout outs to friends and family, Kevin?
I think I've done most of my shout outs. I would, I guess maybe Jadley Javen. They know who they are. That's about it.
Okay. Well, thank you for tuning in. Always remember, the trail is the trail. It doesn't care if you want to go downhill. It doesn't care if it's almost dark and you're looking for a campsite. It doesn't even care if your trail partner has handed you the map. The trail is the trail. Embrace the suck.